Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. Today, I have a big guest. This is a big guest for the, you know, it's, this is going to be huge, right? This is pretty much the co-founder of Prometheus. He's at Prom Labs now, which Prom Labs creates commercial productivity tools around Prometheus. This is Julius Foltz. Did I get that right? There.
Sorry, I think I actually interrupted you.
No. It's good. I mean, look, I want to try to get my German citizenship. I want to make sure I said that right.
Yeah, Foltz.
Foltz. Everybody Foltz. Out there, Foltz. Just like the folks Foltz. I had the Kinvolk folk people on. They corrected me. It's not Kinvolk, Pop. It's Kinfolk.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. There we go. So, Julius, I want to talk to you about just your journey, how you started. You were like, you know, we know up to the Prometheus point. I want to talk about, hey, this is my first thing. I'm an engineer. Here's where I wanted to become an engineer, those type of things.
Yeah, I guess I was one of those lucky children who got started really early. I think at around the age of 5 or 6, my father got a black and white Atari ST computer for word processing. And at the beginning, I was really confused and was just wondering, like, why are we getting another TV? What's this about? But for some reason, there was a basic programming cookbook coming with this computer, or like some colleague of my father had some clue about computers. My father actually didn't. And somehow either my father or someone else like initially helped me type in some of the examples in that book. And there would be like hello world, and there would be circles or ellipses or stuff like that. At some point they got fed up with me and said, do this yourself now. But I was totally hooked by this machine that would execute arbitrary instructions that you would give it, and not just like a washing machine or like a single purpose toaster or so. And yeah, so for the longest time, I actually just, you know, I typed in, copied some of the examples, modified a number, made a circle into an ellipse, and was totally flashed by that. And also played a lot, of course, still on the computer. And, you know, I didn't move that fast until in 5th grade. For the first time, I met another person who also was exposed to programming already, which now is still a good friend of mine. He also went into tech later. And, you know, I saw a sheet of paper sitting on his table at school with pencil, print, welcome to Jurassic Park. And then like the next lines of code. I was like, oh, do you code as well? Yeah, of course. What computer do you have? Atari ST. Oh, me as well. What basic interpreter? Omicron basic. Well, me as well. And so we were like best friends from that day on. And then, you know, of course that developed over time. And then the internet kind of arrived in my life in the mid 90s. And that accelerated a lot of things. And suddenly there were many people in my life doing stuff with computers. Nowadays, I guess it's mainstream. So computer science was always one of these things that just kind of, you know, that I grew up with. And that was one of the possible obvious paths, at least for studying and then for working in, because I really enjoyed it. And it also, there's a lot of demand. And so, yeah, I ended up studying that. That's, I guess, how it all got started.
And then let's talk about getting to the cloud native piece. Cause it, look, you can't have the Atari ST and then jump right into like what you all did with Prometheus. I want to know from the, this is Jurassic Park to now. I want to know that piece. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Obviously I had a lab of clustered Atari STs running some clusters.
emulators still, but you know, right now. Yeah. That's
so great. I loved networking very early on. I think, in the 90s, I read this whole book, TCP IP, and really just loved protocols and how computers speak with each other. Learned Unix, Linux. I just, started hacking with a friend that I just mentioned. I don't know if I should mention that. We were still minors, but we were, you know, at some point in the early internet, we hacked like a larger hosting provider long, long time ago. Then I studied computer science, also with the specialization of going into networking and distributed systems. And after that, I managed to get an internship, or well, still studying kind of before my diploma thesis, internship at Google in Zurich. And that was as a site, it wasn't a site reliability engineer yet. It was in the system operations team, which is like, it was responsible for internal SysOps at Google, like for the actual services that Googlers internally use. But I actually didn't do much SysOp-y stuff. I chose an internship project that was about adding IPv6 support to the IPvS load balancer module in the Linux kernel, which took me a while. I had been reading some Linux kernel development stuff up until then, but it was my first foray into really actually doing Linux kernel development. And it was a lot of work, but eventually that actually made it into the mainline Linux kernel. So there's now a generic netlink interface for configuring IPvS. And that was necessary for even extending IPvS in such a way that it's also IPv6 compatible. So I also added the IPv6 compatibility in there. An early version that still was like very limited, had many bugs. More competent people came after me and actually fixed all those. That's kind of a pattern that we will see later on in my life as well.
No, but you know what? And again, thinking about bringing fire, the whole concept of Prometheus, yeah. Right? And I'm sorry, and again, this is the dovetail into this. You can't have these things, you know, fire. You can't have these things without somebody striking that match and somebody doing that. So again, don't discount yourself. Like, like even pre-interview, like, well, you know, I'm like, listen, man, like you sparked this, man. I'm sorry. I'm a fanboy. We're going to get into it, but I got to say it. So.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, so definitely, I mean, that is in the kernel initially due to me, but now it's much better than what I built initially. Then I went back to study, finished my studies, and had a full-time job lined up at Google, though, afterwards. So that's when, I guess, the real distributed system and SRE kind of stuff happened. Still in Zurich, SRE, in the team at Google that was responsible for Google's production offline backup system. Translated, that means tapes, lots of tapes, in libraries, tape libraries, they're called. They're basically machines that are as big as a small room, and there were many of those in all of the data centers around the globe at Google, basically. The project was called G-Tape. So you have these tape libraries with around like 10,000s of tape sitting along the walls of that little room, and 8 robots moving around in each library, just shifting those tapes from some cells into a drive. There were many drives in the library as well, and those drives were connected using a fiber channel to special racks in the actual Google data center. And everything around that was automated. So, or at least we were aiming to automate as much as possible, because it was a bit of a non-standard thing at Google, right? Like normally you have software and it's software itself is more easy to automate than robots, drives, tapes, like so many things were going wrong. Robots would crash into each other, drop tapes on the floor, drives would eat up tapes, libraries would get out of sync, whatever. So we wrote we didn't write all the software around that, but we wrote a lot of automation software and monitoring for that and so on. We're on call for the entire world. So like if you got an email, it would end up on tape within like, I don't know, half an hour or some reasonable amount of time, so that there would be an offline backup of your user data on a completely separate hardware and software stack. And the scale of this back then was already pretty crazy. So back then, I don't know if I think back then I can say now it was around like 10 petabytes per day shoveled onto tape. So these were like all YouTube original videos, the web index, logs, everything, basically everything that's like relevant in some way to production.
I want to talk about this. And again, I've had a lot of other guests that have been on that worked at Google and everything like that. And it's always like, you know, you're in there and there's just this monster. You have all of this, you know, again, all these efficiencies that you created, because that's kind of the culture there. It's like you're in a culture of, you know, create, and if something needs to be addressed, you address it quickly. So talk to me about were you able to kind of influence like changes with this robot? Because, you know, was it a culture that allowed you to do that? Like, you know, take that spark like you've done your whole career and span it into flame, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think, yeah, the one thing I've always been at least decent at is seeing some spots where I could have impact and then going into them. Maybe nowadays I'm choosing more projects that I really just like working on, but at least, you know, there were obvious, like when you're administrating such a system and you're on call for it, I think that's the best feedback loop to actually find out where the major pain points are and what to improve. I kind of miss that nowadays, I have to say. But there it was really obvious. So there, for example, a lot of these tape drives would go into weird states where they wouldn't unmount a tape properly anymore, or they wouldn't mount anymore, or like some weird other things. So I built a software called the Drive Doctor that automatically tried, like went through a decision tree of different failure states and error messages and tried different remedial methods, like force unmount or power cycle the drive or this and that with a web interface and everything. And previously, like prior to that, there was like way more manual effort involved in like SREs, just like every day looking at what drives are not doing the right thing anymore and like doing all that manually. So I always liked automating these things, and that saved a whole bunch of work. I was also the primary contact for on the GTAPE SRE side for working with Gmail on migrating all of their storage backends from their old GFS-based storage and the associated backups with that to a completely new system. So where the backups would also work totally different. So yeah, was in and yeah, pushed through some other projects during that time. In total, it was 3 years. You know, like GovCloud was one project where like the US government wanted to be able to use Google services, but then they had to be specially put into like physical cages in a data center, separated from other machines and that kind of thing.
Air gapped, right? I think that's the right.
Yeah, some kind of regulations at least. I didn't do the physical stuff of that. I was just sitting in an office and I was writing configurations and some software and migrations and stuff like that. but yeah, I think that early number of years actually being on call was really, really valuable for getting an idea of what matters in production.
Can we talk about that a little more? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but like for young engineers out there, and you know, I think again that practical experience of being in almost the zone of somebody like having issues, it's like it's so valuable. Would you say that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's the best way to learn, just being thrown in. And I remember the first on-call shift I had, I almost got a heart attack when a page came in and I thought the world would end if I didn't figure out in a second what was going wrong. And then, you know, you're getting a bit more veteran. This was a very noisy service in the sense that, you know, like typically, at least what I heard, if you're on call for a mature Google service, like Google Search or so, maybe you get a page per week or something like this. This one at its worst times, and this, you know, has many reasons, in the very worst days we got like 60 pages. And of course our whole job was like, okay, we need to improve the monitoring situation, but also automation, the abstraction, so that this doesn't happen anymore. So we had a very, very high motivation to really improve things, and in the first times, it was a new service, so it was only like homed, the actual administration of it was only homed in Zurich. So there was no other on-call time zone for it. But we had a pretty strict SLA about like when things should end up on a backup. So we actually had like, I think 5 or 7 days being on-call straight, including the night initially, until we got like New York time zone and more relaxed on-call rules. So there was definitely, it was not a normal, like this is not the common experience at Google, I would say, but this was pretty painful, but at least, you know, effective for motivating people to make things better. That's one way to put it.
This month's podcast sponsor is StormForge. StormForge's Kubernetes performance testing and optimization platform is the easiest way to ensure your applications behave the way you want them to, while cutting out unnecessary resources and time spent manually tuning. In alignment with this, StormForge is asking for your help reducing the amount of unused cloud resources, making both a financial and environmental impact in the world today. We want you to help make that impact with us, so visit https://stormforge.io/podcast. That's stormforge.io/podcast to learn more about how you can help erase cloud waste and take the cloud waste pledge. While you're there, try out the free tier, the machine learning backed service, to start saving resources and getting better performance today.
So you did this kind of SRE kind of engineering function, and SoundCloud comes into play, right? So let's talk a little bit about that. And again, one of the themes that I've had from Google, former Google people, is they get out in the world, they're like, oh, there's no cool Borg, or there's no like this for me to click a button and have an environment. So talk to me about, again, going there and then adjusting to a non-Google world, right? Yeah.
That was tough, man. No, I mean, so
there's my soundbite. It was tough, man.
I think nowadays it's much less tough, because the world outside of Google speaks the same language, at least, even if, you know, maybe some technology specific ones at Google might still be years ahead. But you know what was really great at Google, and of course there's also things to criticize, but what was really great was the caliber of people, technically at least, you worked with, the trust that people had among each other, the scale and quality of the infrastructure that you worked with, and the automation around that. Like, you need more CPUs and RAM in some corner of the world, you just click in a web interface, and of course, you know, depending on quotas, et cetera, it would just work. So like, everything was like done properly and automated, and it. But on the other hand, that doesn't make sense for like every small company. You just got to wing it if you're a small startup, or like medium-sized even for some of these things. But when you're huge, it just pays off to do all these things really properly and potentially in-house if you can do it better than others. So what happened with SoundCloud? So eventually, I was never so happy with the city, Zurich. I was really happy with the job, even tried to move back to Berlin, because I wanted to go back to Berlin and stay at Google. But Google was completely against any kind of remote work. So I actually tried that avenue, new manager in another team would already have been like happy to have me work from Berlin, but then higher up said like, nope, we don't do that kind of thing. They were kind of, Google was closing smaller offices at that time to consolidate their workforce into larger offices. And okay, well, I really want to, like, after 10 years of being gone in total, I wanted to go back to my hometown. And the first company that really seemed attractive enough to do that switch was SoundCloud, which at the time was kind of the beacon of startups in Berlin, the YouTube for sound, and had really good engineers, maybe 60 people or so in total. So I joined them in 2012. And at the same time, Matt Proud, another ex-Googler, joined from Google, came to SoundCloud. And we didn't actually know each other before yet, but we obviously had the same technology background, and we were missing the same things. And then we were thrown into this situation where some very intrepid people at SoundCloud were very forward-thinking, and they had already built a cluster scheduler called Bazooka. And at that time, nobody in the world knew what a container was, but they had containers already. Like, there was no Docker yet. There was obviously no Kubernetes yet, but they had built a cluster scheduler in Go already, like Go version 0 dot something, and using raw LXC containers and very dynamic. So, and there were hundreds of microservices already running on this cluster with thousands of services. And whenever a development team redeployed a new revision of one of these services, the actual processes of that service, let's say it's 100, they, like, all these 100 instances would end up on random hosts and random new ports that get dynamically assigned depending on where there's like availability. But the thing is, SoundCloud was pretty unreliable at the time. It was always like down and slow, not working properly. And I think this was one of the motivation to think, you know, Googlers maybe can help us a bit with that. And so this was our main task, trying to, you know, make things better.
But can we talk about that really? And again, yeah. You know, you hear these days about golden signals, you hear about, you know, latencies, you hear cardinality and metrics and all of these fun things, right? There's like, you're coming from a place again, big world containers, LXC containers, and having to preach this gospel out there. It's more of you have to show versus speak. Right now it's easier to say, look, as an SRE, there's these things you have to do. But back in those days, again, they didn't have any of these concepts about rates and cardinality of metrics, none of that. So talk to me about like trying to say, this is kind of how we did it at Google, but this is also like where you also had to take, you know, that hat on and say, look, this is stuff that we're going to have to plan for. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. I think I will get there. Mm-hmm. But first, like our reaction to what we found was...
Oh, yeah, it's even better.
I mean, that's exactly what you're saying. Like none of this stuff existed. So back then, SoundCloud was using around 10 different monitoring systems for different purposes, like no host monitoring, service monitoring, external set monitoring. So you had... And then you had, you know, you had alerting completely separated from data time series collection. So obviously you had Nagios for alerting, you had StatsD, Graphite, Ganglia, Moonen, New Relic, a couple of others like Pingdom. And
but so majority on. Of those are like polling methodologies. They're polling, right? And so you might get like, and you're, you know, these are kernel based, like, you know, again, these, you know, anyway, so I'm going ahead of the thing, but yeah, that's like, you're looking at that like, man, this is late. Something, you're going to lose money because, you know, these latency will slow down somebody clicking play. So I'm sorry, I have to say this. It was awesome stuff, dude.
I think that wasn't really the issue with them. And you know, I mean, Prometheus is pull-based and some of these tools were rather push-based, which has pros and cons, which we can go into at some point. So I think that wasn't the main motivator. But let's say, for example, some of these, like let's say one of these microservices had a latency spike that would send a count, like the latencies would get measured into some StatsD histogram, and that would get serialized out into Graphite. But Graphite, we had like one big installation of it at the company, and the way it persisted data files in the Whisper format wasn't very great. The data model is not very flexible. It's a strict hierarchy without flexible label dimensions, which then Prometheus introduced. The query language had limitations in the way you could actually divide whole sets of time series by another and like do more flexible time series calculation. The UI wasn't great. So especially the dealing with high cardinality and changing time series identities over time, because now in Kubernetes and even in that cluster back then, if you wanted to identify metrics coming from a specific process, you need to put that process ID or pod name or whatever it is into the identity of your time series. And that means that these pods don't live super long. So you might have a completely new set of time series every day or so. So that doesn't go too well with a system that saves one file for every time system on a file system and this kind of thing. Yeah, we looked at OpenTSDB and Graphite and many other available open source tools at the time. And basically in all the aspects that we were kind of looking for, they didn't suit these dynamic systems very well. They didn't have a query language or a good data model or this or that. Yeah, that's the other aspect, what I mentioned with dynamic systems. Not only do you have these quickly changing time series, but you need to actually figure out where the things are that you want to monitor. And for that, it doesn't help to just have a push-based systems where the things just push to you, because you don't know if something should be there that isn't pushing. So if you want to do it properly, you still need to have something like service discovery, something that tells your monitoring system which things should be there. And if you have that information then anyway, then it gets much easier to actually go out and pull from these things. And yeah, so, but what basically we had all these things and we were like, really what we kind of need is something more similar to Borgmon, which we were just using at Google. We were not developing at Borgmon. And that seemed kind of like a bit of an audacious undertaking, and I was very unsure. And actually, Matt was more sure at the beginning that we should just try this. And yeah, so we just started
this. Matt who? I just, for the audience.
Matt Proud. Matt Proud. Yeah.
Shout out.
So what we did in the first 2 or 3 months was just working on this on our weekends. And we kind of split the responsibilities a bit. Like I did config and UI and the query language, and he did like the storage and other things, and then kind of defined interfaces, plugged everything together, also in Go already. And in, like at some point we had a, you know, an initial version that would scrape some data, store it in a really bad TSDB, and show it in a really bad way. And like actually, you know, run a query with a sum and a rate and stuff like that.
Can we talk about this? I want to ask about just scrapers and exporters in general. And here's my question about this is like, you all are sitting in the room and you're like, okay, I want to be able to like have different ways for people to plug in these dimensional data from, you know, you'd be like a node exporter, like eventually like that whole concept, then scrapers. Like I want, you know, explain those concepts to people that, you know, don't have that knowledge, because it's fucking fascinating.
Right. So the whole idea about Prometheus is that, so you run one or multiple Prometheus servers, which are kind of the heart of the whole thing. You configure them to know either statically or integrated with a service discovery mechanism, what should be there, what processes should be present, what hosts, what network devices, what other things that you could potentially pull from. And then the server goes on, out on a regular polling schedule to these devices over an HTTP endpoint. And whenever it scrapes one of those endpoints, that endpoint is expected to return over the wire a text format containing metrics, time series, but only really the current value of each time series that this process tracks. So let's say you have an HTTP server that handles requests over time. Internally in its memory, it would just count up and up and up for every request it has handled. And every time Prometheus comes by and scrapes, it would say, this is how many requests I have handled so far. It doesn't send any history or anything like this. Just like, this is the current number. Just serializes that thing it has in memory anyway. And then Prometheus, because Prometheus does this every couple of seconds, Prometheus itself on its local disk builds a time series database out of that, where you can then track the development of these counters or gauges or other types of metrics that can go up or down, like memory usage or queue lengths. Or there's also histograms and summaries that can do quantile calculation for you. So basically all that's needed to get metrics out of anything you care about is to offer an HTTP endpoint and serve Prometheus metrics on it whenever Prometheus comes by, or any other thing that speaks that format, just serve your current state.
You see how brilliant this is? I mean, you don't like, you are so humble, man. You literally changed the face of monitoring anything.
You know, there's...
You have to, like, I bow to you, man. That is incredible shit you and your co-founder did. It's phenomenal.
I mean, so two things. Thank you. Two things to note about that. Obviously, that's very much what Borgmon did, right? Like the whole architecture of Prometheus is like, people would say basically open source Borgmon, but it's not like, at least we didn't know any of the Borgmon source. So it's more of an inspiration, I would say. So the idea, of course, for pull didn't come directly from us, but we saw the advantages. And the second thing I would want to note about this is that a lot of people hate this pull-based model because it has some disadvantages. Like now your monitoring system, oh, now I need service discovery. And it's like, yeah, but you kind of need that anyway if your monitoring system is supposed to know when something's not pushing to you. The other argument is, which is very valid in some cases, is like your monitoring system now needs to be able to establish a TCP connection to your monitoring targets, which can be pretty tough in some network situations across geographies, or if you have like devices at customers or so. So, you know, or pretty tight security policies within a Kubernetes cluster even. So there, sometimes you have, like, this gets a bit annoying, but it was really built for this case of you have cluster, like, in data center monitoring, where basically you can reach everything relatively easily. So just that said, there's plenty of benefits to this pull model as well. Prometheus already knows what it's pulling from because it needs to know anyway. So it can attach all the awesome metadata to that pull. And the thing it's pulling from, like your process or machine, doesn't have to know, like, the taxonomy of the label names and values of what the monitoring system should call it. So Prometheus is completely in control of, like, how often do I scrape? If it kind of overloads itself, just kind of skips some scrapes. It attaches the right metadata. If you want to have high availability, you run two Prometheus servers. They scrape the same data and do the same alert calculations, and boom. You have more flexibility. Like, what do you actually want to pull? I only want to pull, like, a subset of the metrics of this service, but, like, the full metrics of that other service, for example, into this particular Prometheus server. And into another, I want to have, like, a different view, for example. So it enables some more flexible things and actually requires less configuration than push. Because push, you need to configure both ends. But we're not super opinionated on the push and pull thing. I really like pull. I can also, like, you can go as a human to a service endpoint, see what its current metrics are without even a monitoring system. But there's definitely situations where push is way more convenient operationally. So it kind of has its pros and cons.
What you build and where it takes you shouldn't be limited by your database. CockroachDB helps developers build and scale apps with fewer obstacles, more freedom, and greater efficiency, so you can forget about the database and trust that it just works. Kubernetes-friendly, open source, and indestructible, CockroachDB makes it easier to build and scale apps. It gives companies the freedom to serve customers anywhere, and it's backed by world-class documentation and excellent dedicated support. Discover CockroachDB, the most highly evolved distributed SQL database on the planet. Kubernetes native and built from the ground up to help companies of all sizes, including Bose, Comcast, and Equifax, scale fast, survive anything, and thrive anywhere. Sign up for a free 30-day trial and get a free t-shirt at cockroachlabs.com/podcast. That's cockroachlabs.com/podcast.
Let me ask you this, the name, you know, you're all sitting in a room, you're like, yeah, and again, it's probably so appropriate. Maybe let me take a stab at what I think it was, and then you can tell me if it's right.
Right.
Bringing the fire to people, right? That's the whole Prometheus kind of thing. It's like, you know, you had this idea of, like, I want to be able to, like, you know, open up the kimono in terms of, like, you know, bringing fire to people to be able to, like, monitor these things. But I want to know behind the name, what's the story behind Prometheus as the name?
Yeah, that's pretty good. That gets part of it. I mean, in the more pragmatic sense, we had this in, like, a private GitHub repo, and we're like, we should really create a proper GitHub organization for this. But then we need a name. And then, you know, we went through Wikipedia lists of Greek gods and goddesses and all these things, like these typical lists you go through when you need a cool name for something. And Prometheus then kind of just struck us as sounding cool, being available in that space. And then those analogies rather, like, followed from that. Like, we were not looking for, obviously, that specific analogy immediately, but we're kind of like, yeah, it kind of fits, doesn't it? It's like bringing the fire from the gods, so to say, Google, to the outside world, to humans. Maybe there's a bit of hubris contained in that. Then the other thing is, yeah, generally illumination, right? Like, a monitoring system illuminates things. So it fits great in those aspects.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, yeah, we were lucky that we could actually get the GitHub org, because obviously it was taken already, but it was defunct and unused. And GitHub has this policy where they basically give out organizations that are completely unused. So
got it. And are you kind of just like, wow, I cannot believe how people have adopted this. Like it's everywhere. And again, you know, a CNCF project, you know, graduated project, which kudos again. I'll tell you a story. I have a Prometheus. I was working with a customer, you know, I work at Sysdig, right? And we integrate with Prometheus and the PromQL. And again, it's, I see the fruits of your labor every day, right? And I had a customer that had a metric that we couldn't grab, right? And so it was GPU metric, right? And they were doing some work. And I'm like, he basically told me the repo that he used, he promoted it, sent it over me. I was able to test in my own environment to be able to troubleshoot something so quickly. Think about this. Could you have, if you think about any closed source tool, there's so hard for you to do that interaction to be able to debug or troubleshoot something. Man, like you have no clue. You probably do, but like how much you've impacted everybody that's in this cloud native space. It's phenomenal. But you look at yourself someday and say, wow, I cannot believe this took off the way it did.
Totally. The thing is, you get super fast used to this. Like, let's say you became, I don't know, that sounds weird, but yeah, okay, I'll go at this at a different angle. But like the first days when we finally really published it with a blog post to the public, and it ended up, so this was a couple of years after it had time to mature at SoundCloud. We did a blog post and had a website that I really was adamant on putting in place with proper documentation before we really published this. And someone who we didn't even know managed to get it up to Hacker News on spot number one, which sounds a bit silly, but really I think changed the trajectory of the project, because on that day when it was on that website, that orange website, like all the metrics just shot through the roof. Like obviously GitHub stars, the funny one, but then also just people, you know, getting engaged with the project on our communication channels, filing issues, writing code, et cetera, et cetera. So I think I have no idea without that freak accident whether it would have become that successful. And at the same time, you know, hit the nerve with Kubernetes becoming popular and people needing a monitoring system for that kind of environment. But it felt crazy because, I mean, obviously we kind of created Prometheus initially already on day zero as open source, before fully announcing it, with the intention of a couple of our friends are going to use it and hopefully we can use it at our next job, because something like this should exist. And then we also, before we published it, we didn't think that people would really get it, so to say, because Prometheus does a lot of things differently than previous monitoring systems, the pull architecture, the dimensional versus just hierarchical data model, the query language that is powerful, but also a bit arcane if you're not used to it.
The extensibility of exporters. I mean, right there, you're like, you have to go and, you know, get app checks or some things and all these things versus this, the world is your oyster. If somebody's publishing this metric in some type of, you know, SDK or something like that, you use the NVIDIA thing, you're using the NVIDIA SMI, you get all of those metrics and you can extrapolate, scrape those out. Like how, and the sky is the limit. The sky is, that's the beauty of Prometheus.
So in fairness, like super duper, yes. But of course, like that concept already existed in things like StatsD and Graphite, where there was already a different format for standardized pushing out of metrics out of things. But I think, we definitely just in terms of adoption and
the ecosystem. To the extent of integrating the cloud native and like the host space metric, again, you got to bow. You all are the de facto tool for that.
Integrating all types of metrics, anything that's a numeric time series at least, plus integrating time series with alerting. So not having a separate system for alerting, but actually having one query language that is a unified way to do graphing, ad hoc diagnostics, and actual alerts. That I think was a pretty new approach. Yeah.
Fantastic.
I think you had a question there. About the whole, so when it then all lit up and shot through the roof, I have a journal entry from that, like, couple of days after that happened, or the night, and it's like it reads something about like, this is crazy, I cannot believe it, what the hell. And it was crazy. It felt really, really crazy and totally unexpected because there was no commercial attention behind this or so. But then you just get used to
screenshot, it. Like, screenshot that. I'll put it right here during the interview. I'll put the "this is crazy" journal here.
It's in Sorry, German and it's like in a private encrypted file somewhere.
SIVO is an alternative to the big hyperscale cloud providers. They've launched the world's first managed Kubernetes service powered exclusively by K3S. With sub-90-second cluster launch times, a simplified Kubernetes experience, and predictable billing, SIVO is on a mission to create a better developer experience. Get $250 free credit to get started. Sign up today at SIVOcloud.com/podcast. That's CIVO.com/POPCAST. Go check them out. All right, man. Sorry. So I want to talk to you a little bit about kind of the current, what you're doing now, and talk about, again, PromCon, amazing conference when we used to have, remember when we all used to be able to get together? I mean, I know we're doing virtual stuff as well. So talk to me about starting PromCon.
Yeah. Have you been at one?
By any chance? I think we sponsored one. So it's just a
good Yeah, you did. You did. Yeah, I put your logo onto the banner. I did the design. So 2016, about a year after we fully published Prometheus, we weren't even part of the CNCF yet, but it just occurred to me that it would be so obvious that it would be nice to have a conference around this growing project. And you know, obviously start small. And I just felt like doing something different again in my life. And, you know, how about organizing an event? And so we got Google Berlin to cooperate and give us their office venue, just fit 80 people initially. So really small. But yeah, we got together a bunch of really cool people for the first installment for that conference. And I organized, I guess I would say I organized like maybe 90% of that event, including building the website, designing the schedules and banners and ordering them and everything, doing the CFP. But there was help from Robust Perception already back then, handling the financials because they had a company and they could run the ticketing through it and so on. So that really, really helped. In the years after that, we were in the Google Zurich, Google Munich office, which was 220 people. And at that time, we already were part of the CNCF, which were like more and more helping us with more and more of the aspects of, you know, ticketing and event management and so on. But for us, it's really important that it doesn't become like a completely commercial event. So we want to always keep it affordable. So our ticket prices were like 80 euros. And I think the first one was maybe even 50, I forgot. So really cheap, right? And we also said, like, if you're a student or something, let us know if you can't get in otherwise. Problem is, it always sold out really quickly, like in 1 or 2 hours. But the idea of the conference is really to bring together this whole family of core developers with a strong like core user community, have this exchange of ideas. It really, really has this family vibe sitting in that room. Obviously, it's a bit sad that it's not huge, so not everyone can participate. That's always the drawback, being like more inclusive versus exclusive. It's a bit sad. But it's the physical limit in this case. Yeah, I mean, obviously this year it was planned to take place in Vancouver. We wanted to do a North America version that would be a bit bigger. But then Corona happened and so we moved it online and it was okay. But, you know, online events, everyone's kind of getting a bit tired of them. And they also have their advantage now. Again, like, oh yeah, everyone can actually be there and participate, but you don't get that feeling of like people laughing in a room and you're doing like interactive stuff together.
The hallway track, the late night beer at the Marriott or wherever you're at. I mean, there's nothing that compares to that. You know, you build those relationships, you're able to like, you know, talk to people. And no, I totally agree with you.
I really miss that, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Prom Labs really quick. Tell me about it. Like, this is, you know, again, we got your past, we got your middle. Let's get with what you're doing going forward.
Yeah. So 2016 already, I had left SoundCloud a while ago and I had taken a break. And at that point, companies started asking me to help them use Prometheus, extend Prometheus, build on top of Prometheus. Cortex, for example, was one of these projects that I was initially involved with, which was started by Weaveworks to be a horizontally scalable re-implementation with different trade-offs than Prometheus. So I did a lot of freelancing of that kind of sort, consulting, training, custom development work over the years, and got an idea for an actual commercial additional project to Prometheus end of last year, which was the thing I'm building now, PromLens, PromQL power tool and query builder that makes the whole sometimes painful PromQL experience much nicer. So I anyway, I'll go into that. But that was a bit of the impetus of saying, okay, if I want to actually try and sell commercial software, I need to have a proper company and not just be a freelancer. And in Germany, you need to have like a Gewerbe at least. So, but you know, when I do that, I was obviously thinking about, okay, let's do it properly, buy the domain, get a name, and decided for Prom Labs in the end. There isn't really, I mean, there's Robust Perception in Dublin, which is Brian Bresel from our Prometheus core team, which is also a company centered completely around just Prometheus. But as far as I know, there's no other company that is also doing product development solely focused on Prometheus. And yeah, and so I'm doing product development, exploring some new tools like PromLens with this company, but also still continuing to do, and what I really love, the consulting, the training, and the development. So I really need that to stay in touch with companies and their use cases and see what's actually happening out there. I wouldn't be happy like just developing the software.
The interaction with people using it is probably gives you the most inspiration, would you say?
The interaction with the people and the actual infrastructure. Because, gotcha. You know, at some point, that's a bit of the challenge. If you're not on call anymore, if you're not long-term responsible for infrastructure, it's tough to really stay in touch with what is important, right? And I would say that even like PromLens was a product that was born out of my own like wanting to scratch an itch again, where I just saw both myself, but also other people maybe not always struggling using PromQL, but it's sometimes, even if you know the language PromQL really well, if you don't exactly know the shape of data you're working with at every node and sub expression and binary operator and so on, it gets really tough to get like everything right in more complex expressions where you have multiple binary operators and filters and set operators and et cetera, et cetera. So I really thought like, okay, there needs to be a tool that visualizes the structure of your query in a way where it draws it as a tree, shows the exact data at every subnode, what cardinality, what available labels do you have at every subnode, how do they fit together. Now also it has an editor with really amazing autocomplete, which the Prometheus built-in interface doesn't have. And you can click on any node and it explains it to you. So there's an explain tab, which tells you like, this is the meaning of this function or aggregation. This is exactly what it does. For these really hard to get right, sometimes binary operators with label matching, it shows you in this explain view how the matching works between the left and right hand side. So like it helps you get things right a lot. So for me, it's like a power tool for PromQL and an editor, which just makes things so much nicer. I can't use the normal Prometheus interface anymore for doing PromQL. It's just,
It's awesome. Yeah, and I've played with it. It's fantastic stuff, man. Let me ask you this, kind of changing gears a little bit. So again, you know, doing all this, you know, metrics work, time series, it's big on the brain. It's hard on it, right? What do you do for your spare time? What do you do to, besides drink amazing coffee, what is it you do?
I do drink amazing coffee in the morning. This is a tea now. I spend way too much time watching YouTube videos and other stuff like other people. But besides that, I love bouldering and climbing. Way too much in the gym, though. I would like to do that more outside. I go running regularly.
Have you done mountaining with Chris Nova yet?
I have not. No.
She climbs a ton of mountains, so it would be awesome to see you both climb some crazy mountains.
In the US also, they have like their amazing nature right in front of the doorstep with like, you know, Utah and Yosemite and all that. I'm so envious of that. That would be great. What was I gonna say? Generally, I love science and anything like just learning about the world, going into nature, and then the usual stuff, like what everyone does, hanging out with people.
My wife is from Poland, right? She's from a place called Szczecin, which is right near Berlin, right? And we fly into Tegel all the time. And I'm this preconceived notion of what Berlin is. And you get inside and you go outside. It's such beautiful land there. It's like, there's beautiful green, you know, people take, it's just beautiful there. And so like, you know, I can understand how you enjoy nature, because once you get out of that, you know, people have this preconceived notion of Berlin being this gray and, you know, dark, and it's beautiful around the area, Germany. So I can understand that. That's amazing.
Yeah, actually, I like Berlin as a city. It has a lot of green areas, but still it's a city and it's nice. It's quite spacious. So it has a lot of space for people and a lot of green areas, but it takes a long while like to actually get out and to be in nature that is not just, just like meadows and forests, okay. But if you want to get to like mountains, that's like at least a couple of hours away.
Gotcha. So I'm going to ask you the last question. Again, this has been a complete honor talking to you, but what work are you most proud of in your career?
I guess still Prometheus at this point. It wasn't expected, but I'm obviously like really proud that it got to the point where it is now, definitely. Another thing I would say, I always kind of stayed true to myself and just, you know, figured out over time what do I actually want and what do I want to do next. And so for me, you know, like creating the conference, and I did so many different things. I think this whole reinventing I like. I did front end. Right now I'm doing front end. It's all React and TypeScript. A couple of years ago I organized an event as like my main activity, and before that I it was Prometheus, still Prometheus of course, and before that it was kernel development. So I like kind of this jumping between different worlds, trying out different things. That probably doesn't make me the best person in any one of them, but makes me a good person to kind of have an overview of things. And I like that. And just kind of working on whatever kind of makes me most joyful at the moment.
Julius, you are a legend. You're an icon. I thank you so much for being part of the podcast. You have no idea, again, how you've impacted not only my life, but a lot of people in the cloud native and Kubernetes space.
Thank you very much. That was a blast.